Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does it take to conceive and create things which have never existed before? The question is a lifelong challenge and inspiration for sculptor Tony Cragg, who began his career working in a lab, but soon found himself more interested in making visual representations of his experiments than in the way they turned out. After art school, he gained global attention for large-scale mosaics and sculptures fashioned from plastic trash and other found objects, and went on to work in wood, bronze, stainless steel, and fiberglass. He joins us for the hour to talk about his work. Tony, welcome to Think.
Oh, how do you do?
You have said that a sculptor's job is to make things that aren't there. Talk about what that means to you.
Well, we know there's a huge vocabulary of things that nature makes for us. I mean, there's stuff all around us. And maybe at some point it seemed as if artists were interested in copying nature. And that's become, for whatever reasons, less of an appropriate thing for artists to do. So what's left is, in a sense, to sort of try and fill in the gaps of what's missing, you know. So, I mean, what we actually see around us when you see into the world, you see a lot of things like the cup on the table and the chairs next to the table and all those things, but they're very repetitive. They're in the next room and the next room and the next and the next house and the next house. And that can't be the full vocabulary of forms of reality. That would be a very impoverished material world. So, and I think there are many, many sorts of things, many things one can make. And I think that's a job of art. It's definitely a function for sculpture to do that, yeah.
When you talk about things that are repeated in different environments, it's interesting. There's all this research now to show that novel experiences are the things we remember and therefore make our time on this earth seem longer because we recall them as opposed to sort of glossing them over with our minds.
Yes, I mean, we do. I think we sort of make things in short form in our memories and everything. I mean, that's other we wouldn't manage to be able to manage with that the amount of data that we usually in a day's experiences could have to put up with. So, obviously, we do in our memories and in our way of looking at things break it down. But still at the same point, that doesn't mean the wide base of the experience. It shouldn't be shortened down, you know. I think you should keep that as rich as possible.
How did you discover that you were born to be an artist? Or do you feel that you were born to be an artist?
No, I don't actually. I didn't. For whatever reason, my father was an aeronautical engineer, and in Britain in the 40s and 50s, we as a small child we moved everywhere that there was an aeroplane to be built. Mm-hmm. And I thought that my father's generation thought science would sort of solve all the problems of the world, and I thought, just as his son, I'd probably do something like that. And it was easier as well to in school to follow science curricula and mathematics, because they're pretty more conform everywhere in the world, and then to follow the humanities. So I didn't really have very much to do with art. It was really so I started to study. Biochemistry, a very lowly, I was only 18, 19 after school, it was a very lowly position as a laboratory assistant. And, you go there with this sort of child, this schoolboy's dream of a life in science. And after sort of working for a while, sort of looking for an antioxidant for polyisoprene, a very minute part of the universe, very abstract and very smelly, I just got bored. And they were great years. They were the years 68, 69. So I had the feeling, and there was a lot of things going on around me. And I started to draw in that situation, and more or less that just out of boredom. And then those drawings became much more important than the laboratory, as you said.
But you were in art school and you wanted to draw. You did not want to make sculpture.
No, that's true. I actually was the last thing I wanted to do. I went to a very traditional academic art school to start with, where they teach you how to do prints and make some ceramics and all those model heads and all those things. And at some point they said, and I wanted to draw and paint, and they said, well, next week you have to... you're going to be making a sculpture. And I thought, oh, God, make a sculpture sounds terrible. And so I started to do that on the Monday morning, and rather loathingly, I have to say. And I was, within a very short time, really absorbed with it. I thought I realize with every change of form and every change of line, surface, composition, volume, there was a different idea attached. There was a different emotion attached to it. And it was just like, well, it's like real life. And we're looking at each other from across a table. Mm-hmm. If I stick my tongue out, you, it's a very small amount of material that I'm showing you. But it changes
it's
the
totally
shape.
A totally different thing.
Yes, but you think, well, the guy's nuts, doesn't mm-hmm. he? Because so the relationship of form and our thoughts is very, very fast. It's a real life film.
As you are going along, and I would imagine some of these works take a very long time from envisioning them to actually having them be completed works. Does the way you feel about them change during
the
radically. Course of
the time? No, I think that anyway. This isn't design. This is making something. I mean, there's no point in doing it if I know where the journey ends. So. Mm-hmm. I start off with obviously with some notion of what I want. And it's usually really just a kind of feeling about what I want, you know, something that is not a great idea. I mean, I don't believe in, you know, good ideas make good art. It definitely doesn't. There are a lot of good ideas that make awful art. And some great art that's not being very good ideas. So I start off with this some way, and then I really just watch the material and learn from the material and get, I mean, it sounds odd, but you get into a dialogue with the material and you end up somewhere in the conversation where you hadn't expected to end up.
What do you mean a dialogue with the material? With the properties, the physical
properties?
Yes,
well, I mean, you know, I mean, not many people make sculpture, most of us still can write. So, mm-hmm. you know, you have an idea in your mind. You say, oh, well, and so you write that sentence down. You take a pencil and a piece of paper and you write that idea down. And in writing it down, you think, well, you know, that's not really a very good word. So you change that word and you maybe put a phrase in it and you find another kind of embellishment to the sentence. And sometimes, and I think most people know that, you write sentences which are much stronger, much more meaningful than the original thought. Hmm. That is poesis. Not poetry, but the old Greek poesis, which just means creation. It's been interpreted as just being poetry because, I mean, literary people have taken it for themselves. But that is working with material, thinking with material. And so what you've done, you've actually taken a pencil, which is a piece of graphite, a piece of carbon, and rubbed it around in front of you on a piece of cellulose and looked for form. And looking for form, working with that material, has actually sort of, there's been a dialogue takes place. And you in that form, you find the content, you find meaning. And that's for writers. It's the same for musicians. They make the air vibrate. It's only material just vibrating in front of them. And they bend it and change it the way they want it. And that's how sculpture making works as well.
Most writers will say that they, I guess now figuratively because they do this all on a computer, but there are a lot of pieces of paper wadded up in the trash before they finish what they're doing. Does the same thing happen for you?
Absolutely, yes. No, it's enormous. I mean, I'm working on about, I can't really say, but I think I've probably started about 30-odd works at the moment. Some I've been working on for 4 years and they don't seem to be going very far. And some I may have just started in the last week or two. But sometimes you get to an impasse and you can't go on or things become more complicated than I imagine they would do. So there aren't any rules about it. The main thing is just to keep occupied and keep pushing the problem, keep changing the material.
Early on when you were working with found objects and trash, to what extent was it a part of the process to actually go out and comb the beaches and look around trash cans and find these materials that you worked with?
Well, it was a kind of social gesture. I mean, first of all, there's always a history, an art history. I mean, and then there's a personal history. And I went to art school in 1969 and it was studied in the 70s in London and west of England. And that time was a time where people were sort of, there were art movements like Arte Povera and even pop art, which was based on sort of found materials and all sorts of things. So there was that cultural history going on. And one without, as a young person, without really questioning very deeply, you just, you know, that's how you make art. And on the other hand, I also had no money. So, I mean, where was I going to get any materials from anyway? So you sort of steal them. The fact that art history had sort of, you know, at the end of the 19th century, there are very few materials for making sculpture with, you know, wood, stone, bronze, whatever. And after Duchamp introduced the pissoir and all the other things, all the materials and objects from an industrial society, suddenly the vocabulary of materials for making art with was very much expanded. And that really, I think that dominates the 20th century art making, is people rushing around the world looking for materials and objects that they bring from a non-art world into the art world. And simply that contextual change is an excitement. It changes the meaning of the work, of the object. And you suddenly realize, when people realize at a certain point, that you could take the same object, but just change the terms around it, the language associated to it, and effectively you transform that object by just changing the language around it. So that's how that worked. I was a student. I had a tandem bicycle in London, and I modified the back seat because nobody would ever go along with me for some reason. But anyway, modified the back seat to a platform, and I used to sort of cycle around London collecting all sorts of materials and stacking it up and taking it back to the studio. Very much part of the process.
And was the organizing and the sorting also something that sort of helped you collect your thoughts?
If you asked me then what this was all about, I would have said it's about categorization, it's about sorting, it's about challenging my own aesthetics. I mean, I was very often finding material in rubbish dumps or in building sites or on the road, which basically I didn't like organic material, but a lot of things that nobody would want to make art with. I mean, and it was like, well, is this going to be meaningful at all to take this into the studio? So sometimes dealing with a lot of things and expanding my own personal vocabulary of material and forms in doing that.
I was reading an essay that you wrote a couple of years ago about going back to this idea of being sort of a part of the time and place in which you emerge to do this work. And it made me think, and you wrote a little bit about this, that had Da Vinci been born when Picasso was and Picasso born when Da Vinci was, they might both have been brilliant but made entirely different kinds of works.
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's no doubt about that. That would be totally relevant for Da Vinci too. But, I mean, that's a little bit of a twisted way to think about things. I mean, it doesn't apply just to art. That would apply to politics and science and everything else. So, I mean, it's just the history of people, of human beings' ideas and philosophy. That's it.
Does there come a point where you feel less connected to the generation in which you emerged, and then you feel like, as a sort of fully realized artist, you can just sort of do what you were meant to do?
I very quickly, while I was still at art school, I mean, I was, as it's inevitable, as a student, you're always at least influenced and impressed by the things that are going on around you. And I was amazingly impressed by land art, by Arti Pauvre, by minimal art, by conceptual art. Artists like Don Jordan, Carl Andre, Richard Long, Gilderton George, Joseph Beuys, lots of different artists, which I found interesting. But already by the mid-70s, I didn't factually belong to that generation, and I didn't share their ideas. And also this sort of more conceptual, I'm definitely not a conceptual artist. I mean, I believe there probably are concepts at the back of what I'm doing. I hope there are. But that's not the front line of the work, is a concept. And that's something I rejected very consciously in 1975.
My guest this hour is sculptor Tony Cragg.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is sculptor Tony Cragg. So, Tony, I think everyone who is not an artist recognizes the talent that it takes to create things that have never existed and express yourself through objects and images. I'm also curious about the process of learning to work with the materials that you work with. I mean, do you leave art school with everything you need to know to cast things in bronze and to carve stone and to do the things and work with the materials that are so much part of your work today?
No, I definitely. I mean, I think it'd be useful. I have students that I try to convince them there are some advantages of knowing those things. But I think also I didn't leave art school really knowing very much about process. I decided what I was interested in, what sort of range of expression I wanted. The themes of the work started to sort of become clear to me. But I didn't know how to make it. Therefore, I didn't know what to make it with. And so, we talked about the early period where I was just sort of collecting a lot of materials. And I was very fortunate. I started shortly after I left art school. I was invited to do a lot of exhibitions. And there were a lot of, in the late 70s, there were a lot of what was called survey shows. So I took part in those and from that had possibilities to do other exhibitions. And for the first time, sort of lower middle class English boy could sort of, young person could travel around the world, and I had a little bit of money, and just started to have sort of a performative activity, going from one gallery or museum to the other and making the work, finding the material and developing the themes while I was making the work, sort of thing. And at some point, after maybe 4 or 5 years of that, 82, first of all, I was very tired, traveling all the time and whatever. And I just realized also that I was beginning to rely on a kind of repertoire of making stuff.
And things you already knew how to do.
Yes, exactly. Because, you know, it worked last time. Why wouldn't it work this time? Mm-hmm. And there was a public coming in a week's time. And I was very often found myself standing with an object or a material in my hand that I'd found and just thinking, what would happen if I had more time to, what would I do with it if I had more time to work with it, to change it, to influence its form? And 82, 83, I just thought, that's enough travel. That's mm-hmm. why I'm not interested at all in installations and sort of performative work in my own work. I mean, what others do, it's up to them, but I don't find that interesting. And so I got a bigger studio and I got some guys in, some friends, and we just learned how to make the forms and stuff, started from scratch after art school.
Does it always turn out the way you want it to turn out once you have decided exactly what something should be?
What do you want? I mean, wanting is a nice thing, isn't it? But do you know what you want? No, I don't. I don't really know what I want some of the time, and it very rarely turns out the way I want it to be. I mean, it turns out the way it wants to be. And, you know, I can work late at night working on a sculpture and go back home feeling great. I've made it really work. This is going to be fantastic. And, you know, wake up in the morning, rush into the studio to take a look at it and think, what idiot make that? That's terrible, you know. But then you sort of, the bit you cut off and it's laying there, the bit you've rejected, well, that looks interesting. Mm. And so you start maybe working on the bit I cut off, you know, and sort of maybe that's a new beginning or something. So, no, that's part of what I say that you do, I think, with material. I think you can think with material. And wanting too much isn't, you know, if it's all preset, then it really predetermined, then it doesn't really sort of, it's not very helpful in terms of a dialogue. It becomes uneven.
It has to take discipline to keep your mind that wide open to something that you didn't intend the day before becoming the focus of what you do tomorrow.
Yeah, that's quite scary. It was scary when I started to do it, because I just thought, where am I going on this? I mean, is there any... But then one or two things worked out, and so I carried on. But there is a lot of failures. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, stuff goes by the wayside. I mean, I don't believe in making art where you sit on the sofa and like, oh, I need here a big blue plastic elephant. You know, I mean, that's some artists do that. They sort of think up the parameters of the work. They go and make it or get it made. And I want to make, you know, I love the idea of an artist sort of sitting, even sounds romantic and crazy comparison, but an artist like Van Gogh sitting in a field, powers those quantum on photons of energy going onto the canvas, changing it, turning it around, having a sort of experience with the picture and putting different things into it and discovering things for himself in it. That I find exciting. I love the process. I have a real adrenaline working and getting the process, getting the work made that way. And that's, I find, much more exciting than just sort of this is the end product. I don't know what the end product would be.
Well, it seems like a radically different understanding of what art is. If your process is about discovering things for yourself, there are artists whose purpose is to communicate an idea that they have formulated to other people and sort of convince other people to, if not think the way they do, at least
then they should
see
go into politics. That would be a nice idea. No, I think that's, I mean, there's a lot of art. I mean, I don't criticize other people's art. They can do what they want. But I think there are lots of themes and there are lots of things that are incredibly important. They are more important than politics. They're more important than sociology. They're essential things about our existence, and we can find forms and ways of expressing them or approaching them. And I think that's real content. And I think that you formulating messages and wanting to be right or wrong about things, I'm not up for that.
Talk about this. You have said that there is ultimately some practical value to allowing artists to not have to create anything practical, but to work with materials and with ideas simply for the sake of sort of discovering what can be done with them. And I may be paraphrasing
a little bit, but I mean, I try and put it not simply, but directly. And just, we use materials all the time. We're sitting here, we're dressed, we're sitting on chairs in a room, in a house, on a street, in a city, an enormous amount of materials, because that is how human beings, that's our survival strategy. We use materials because in a way that helps, that is enables us to survive better, keep us warm, whatever. And so all of the things we do, inevitably they have to function. So everything you can see in this room and around us is the form has been derived through its functionalism, utilitarianism. The problem is that when the way we make things, everything is straight-lined, flat-surfaced, circular, or cut out in a geometric way, because that's the way the machines and the economic systems we've developed make things. So we're incapable of really making something organically complicated. We don't make anything that has the complexity of an animal or a plant or anything like that. We just keep making very, very simple things. And in fact, we impoverish the world. I mean, if we cut down a square mile of rainforest, we'll probably just make it into a field with a few thousand pineapple trees on it or something. So, and they'll be standing in lines. There'll be no insects. There'll be no animals on that piece of ground. So for our own needs, we simplify and impoverish the form around us. And I think, so utilitarianism, in a sense, is a sensor, and it limits the forms in the world around us. And I think that sculpture, because it is, or art in general, because it's free of utilitarian forces and drive, it lets things just grow into space in a way that is, that's not bound. It has other rules. You make the things that do not exist. You know that, if you're just everything we make is bound just by purposeness, then we end up in a very, very poor world. Especially given that human beings are always looking for the easy solution. You know, so we simplify. We want quick and easy solutions, and we simplify, and that's the way we. I won't say we destroy the world, but we certainly don't make it into a better place.
We have an email here from John in Fort Worth who writes, "Do you agree with this perception that no matter what my level of skills are, no matter how much I desire a specific finished product, the medium has a power of its own that cannot be conquered?"
Medium. I don't know what the medium would be.
And perhaps the material?
About the material, yes. I think that... I think material is amazingly powerful. I mean, it does have whether we're here or not here, the material's there, and it is incredibly powerful. And I mean, I get lambasted all the time because I actually say of myself that I, and you know, a sculptor without material doesn't have a job to do. So that's, and I've been caught tempted very often to say I'm a materialist, which always ends gets me into trouble because first of all there's a sort of historical sort of centuries between theologists and philosophers where you know the church tries to prove that if you you know, at all interested in something scientific and analytical, that you're a materialist and you're, and you have some failing spirituality or something. And even today, if I would say to you, you're a materialist, you wouldn't take it as a compliment, would you? So there, this has its derogatory thing. But on the other hand, tell me what else there is. And the material, you, me, everything around us, everything I know, you can speculate about other things that are not material, but I wouldn't know what they would be. Even my voice is only the vibrations of my my own body in the air coming to your ears, you hearing, the change that touches the nerve center that sends the message to your brain and initiates thoughts about what I'm sending to you in the air. This is all just physical stuff. It's sometimes incredibly complicated, and we don't know exactly the basis of our emotions or our intellect, but they are, our emotions and our intelligence are phenomena of the material. So the material, rather than being something cheap or something inferior, in fact is sublimely complicated and fantastic. I mean, so I, in terms of looking at material, I think there's so much more to learn. There's all we can ever do. I mean, from babies onwards, we learn from the material. We, you know, we open our eyes one day, being new here on the earth, and we have very little in our mind, and immediately data from the outside world starts to flow in through our brains. We hear it, we feel the temperature, we hear noises, we smell things. All our senses are picking up on the material and forming a picture in our minds. And actually, that after a certain while, we can use our minds again to affect that material outside of us, you know, demand more food or whatever it is, you know. And so these, we are intricately bound up with the material, with the media, if you like. There is no separation. There is not, I'm here and there's the material. I am the material.
Does it ever strike you as strange or frustrating that these ideas that sort of occupy, they're at the very center of what you do and what you think about all the time, that they are not central to many other people's way of understanding the world?
Well, I think that's quite appropriate. There are so many millions of people in the world. Why, and all of us, we've all talked about freedoms and democracy and all those things. I accept readily that people have different ideas about the world, and that everybody has something to contribute, I think. And you know, say we're wrong. I mean, we all have certain kinds of, we know certain things, everybody. And then there are many more things we don't know. So, and once you go beyond that horizon of what you know and into the area of, then there's only belief. So beyond the sort of horizon of what you know, there's only belief systems. And so, and everybody has to believe. You know, I mean, the most agnostic of us all, at some point, you still have to believe in something. And that's, I think, but it's very difficult if you get people just arguing about their beliefs. You know, I mean,
there's no way to disprove a belief.
No, absolutely, because that, you see what a mess we're getting in the world because people arguing about beliefs. In the end, argue or discuss or base a course of action on what we actually think we know rather than what we believe, you know. So with all respect for anybody's belief, I think you... the material and the real world, the reality of the world, is much more fruitful as a basis for discussion.
Let's go to the phones now. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also get to us by sending an email to think@kera.org. We have John calling from Dallas. Hello, John.
Hey, good afternoon, Tony. And
hi.
I appreciate y'all taking my call.
Pleasure.
I was just sitting here cutting up a Foster's can when the show came on. I'm an artist, and I had an accident, which included a head injury about 7 years ago. and didn't touch my tools for several years. And I started pulling things out last year and, you know, trying to make something. And it changed me a lot. And what I found is I could do my technique and process, but looking at things, they were just, the art is hard, it's becoming hard to pull from my head. So I just wondered if you had anything that you did when you just drew a blank.
Oh, drawing a blank is quite just a common part of the game, I think. You don't have to worry about it. The main thing is you actually enjoy what you're doing, and you feel that the time you spend doing is sensible and achieve something for you. And don't think too much about the end product or anybody else's expectations about it. It's something you do for yourself and enjoy doing it.
Is it harder for you not to think about the end product and people's expectations when you have a global reputation? I mean, is that
I think it's easier.
Really? Well, yeah. Because like it no matter what.
I don't care. I mean, that's the whole base. I mean, that's the last thing I ever want to hear where I'm working is what anybody thinks of the work. Hmm. And afterwards as well, I mean, everybody, you know, it's very nice when people come and say, well, I actually thought that was quite interesting, Tony. And then another one may say, well, that's, your work's terrible. It's the rubbish. What am I supposed to do with that? I mean, there's nothing. That's not helping me at all. I just this is just one person's opinion and my own position in the world, and I'm trying to develop to the best of my ability. And I just wish people like John and everyone, they just get on and develop their position. That's all there is to it.
My guest this hour is artist Tony Cragg. We'll resume our conversation in a moment. You can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is sculptor Tony Cragg. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Paul in Farmers Branch, who wants to know, how do you think about gravity? When do you give in and when do you resist? It's a question I
that's
wish I'd
really
written myself.
That's a really good question, isn't it? Yeah, that's a real sculptor's question. I mean, gravity is one of the most essential things for a sculptor, is somehow has something to do with static, about the sort of way we're in the space. And that goes back to figurative sculpture as well. And you see them standing on one toe, firing an arrow and all this. So they have this fantastic kind of, what are they doing? They're actually defying gravity. You know, they're showing that they have enormous power. They can not quite fly, but they can. They have this. They can lean way out. You know, whether it's the ballerina from Degas or whether it's Rodin sculptures, they show the figures transcend. They always have these limbs that go out like that. Everything that sort of is pulled down by gravity, and it's a fact actually that our brain sends us a message about 8 times a second, goes to our spinal cord, and tells us so how to adjust the spine, unconsciously, obviously, to ourselves. If that doesn't happen, you start to fall over. And, you know, if you drink enough beer, you will. You know, that message stops coming and you fall over. And so once you're lying there, if you lie there long enough, you know, subject to gravity, the energy goes out of you and one day you'll just seep into the ground, and that would be... So the gravity pulling you into the grave, which is what that is taking energy away from you. So energy is, gravity is an enormous force. And it's something, you know, we get up in the morning and our hopes are up high, and we move our bodies energetically and our thoughts energetically, and we try and we transcend the sort of things, everything that's pulling us down, keeping us out of the grave. And that's really what that's what a lot of sculpture is about. Is showing, is in terms of its great big constellation, it sort of shows, it's a sign of human vitality, of being alive, and the energy for that.
In terms of physically fabricating your work, do you have to sort of mathematically calculate what will stand up properly and what might fall over when you put it in a gallery space?
Well, I did not so much in a gallery space. I'm very good at it, but
you have a sense.
A good sculpture doesn't fall over. Because that would be ridiculous. I mean, even when I'm doing the drawing, I can see it's not going to fall over. But when you build it,
there might be times when you want it to look like it could fall over, but have it stay in one spot.
Well, that's not really my case. But I mean, the fact is, though, to answer, if you start making sculpture in a public situation, going outside, you more or less have to have a building permit. And
the base, really?
Oh, yeah, it's everything that goes outside. I mean, nobody's going to let you put things out there in the environment that could topple over, be blown over by the wind. If children climbed up on, they would fall over, or is poisonous, or could cut somebody badly. So they could spear themselves on it or point their eye out. And so there are also, so an engineer will come along and have to go through all of these details. So the artistic freedom of this and that and whatever. Once you start, that's okay in your studio, and you may, in the premise of a sort of private gallery and eventually within the confines of a well-organized museum, you can do all those things. But the fact of the matter, if you just want to compete with the everyday objects out on the street, with all the buses and the cars and the telephone boxes and the whatever else there is out there, then you have to prove you. Then there has to be a sort of engineering certificate for it.
What is your studio like?
The studio is, I live in this city in Germany, Wuppertal, which is an old textile city, a very long, winding city along a deep valley. It's very hilly. And I love it because it's beautiful landscape in that area, very forested, very typically German. And then in the crevices of the valleys, there is old industry and the beginnings of new industry and whatever else. So there's a kind of juxtaposition of nature and man making things. And so that's, I find, stimulating. And I have a studio which is right on the top of a hill overlooking a sort of a forest. It's quite big. I haven't worked out how big it is in feet, but I suppose it's about 10,000 feet or something. It's, probably a bit more, but it's full of materials and sculpture and a few machines to make stuff with. And I'm just a small, now slowly getting older person, so I don't make everything myself. And this was a decision I made, again, going back to 1982, you know, when I once found out, you know, that's what I wanted to do, to make the stuff. Then I couldn't mix up all the materials and buy the material and cut or grind all the surfaces down on my own. I got people to help me in. But I want to be involved in the making. You know, it is possible for artists, and I think it may work for them, that you can just do a drawing or a model and you send it off and somebody, you know, they're a great sort of hand craftspeople and they can make the work for you. But the thing is, then the sculpture comes back and I don't know who he is at all and how he got to be like that. And I've missed the whole process and I have no relationship to it whatsoever. So I want to be there. And I have about 12, 15 people that work with me and actively making things. And I rush around and look at one thing and change things, make some changes, do a bit of drawing, cut bits off and... couple of rude conversations every now and with some of the people. No, but the people that work for me are fantastic. I mean, I without their help, I couldn't do that, but do anything. But they're prepared. They come in and I say, no, that's not how I thought. So we work together for an hour and really turn around what they've done and do what they've done and start off in a new direction. They take it and they just get on with it. And that's really the terms of employment there in a way. Be patient with me. Yeah.
Is it an art or a science to communicate to them what it is that you intend them to do?
It's just some certain kinds of work, certain people don't get it. That's for sure. And then other people, there are a lot of people that actually want to work in the studio. We've got a lot of people applying to come and work there. And it strange enough, I mean, it's probably quite hard to do. I think it is. I mean, it sounds like a naive, silly thing to say, but it's actually quite difficult to make sculpture. You've got to have the material, you've got to know how to deal with the materials and whatever. And if somebody starts work, we start a lot of people, and after maybe a week, or after a day, we know.
Thank
and
you,
they,
please
and
go.
They know. We know and they know that's just never going to be. So that's,
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We will take another call now. This time we have Matt on the phone from Dallas. Hello, Matt.
Hello. I was wondering if you would please talk about some of your favorite sculptures at the Nasher Sculpture Center, please. Thank you.
Oh, yes, with pleasure. In the Sculpture Center, it is one of the really most incredible collections of sculpture in the world. And I was fortunate enough to know Ray Nasher many years ago and his family. And
you have two works in the permanent collection.
Yes, I have two works in the collection. But one of my very favorite artists is Medardo Rosso. I think he's very, I mean, for me, he's the first modern artist, in a sense, modern sculptor. He stopped kind of making figures that sort of tried to be copies of human beings. And suddenly he made a figure that's like looking at somebody else. It's a one-to-one. You see the skin, you see the perspiration on the surface of the skin, you see the imperfections, the tension in the musculature, the atmosphere of the face. And I think his work is absolutely, for me, eminently wonderful and impressive work. And then the group of Giacometti's that is in the collection is like, it's just simply one of the best collections of Giacometti's I know of, and they're fabulous. So there's some, and I just know that the Nashers, Ray Nasher in particular, his wife, they spent so much time and were so particular and so well informed. They really just pick really great art every time. There are very few things that they got involved in that they didn't really sort of know the background to very, very well. They were very well informed. And when we come to the more contemporary work, I mean, it's the same. It continues as well in the same way going through and see Marc de Sauvre and Serra and all the great artists. I mean, I think more than just the particular individual works, and there are very many in the collection, I think what is really astonishing is that this collection is a document of how fantastic the history of sculpture has been in the last 100 years. At the end of the 19th century, sculptors were only concerned in copying the figure. And then comes Rodin and Medardo Rosso. And Rodin, suddenly, he doesn't just copy the surface of the sculpture. He suddenly, because there's the influence of things like Freud, so he knows that the forms of the world are not just human world anyway, are not just governed by some physicality. They're also governed by psychology. So stress and so he traumatizes the material. He breaks them and he twists them and does things unnaturally. They're not anymore copies of the human figure, but they express something about the human figure. And Medardo Rosso, as I've just said, I mean, who suddenly makes looking at sculpture not a silhouette you can see from a big distance, not a power symbol. It makes it a small, intimate experience. It's the same as looking at your own wife or child or somebody you love or even hate, as far as I'm concerned, but getting up close to someone and experiencing them. So that's the beginning. And then after that, someone like Duchamp arrives and introduces enormous vocabulary of industrial objects into sculpture making, and it just goes on. The line of figuration, of developing the figure, has increased. But as it's from copying nature and the human figure, it has really evolved into a basic study of the material world in a very, very fundamental way. And there are almost no areas or themes, topics that are not that sculpture hasn't approached and dealt with in some way. And I think, you know, it doesn't deal with the material world in the same way. As I say, as scientists, they try to understand the fundamentals. But it does give the material world sense and value, and I think that's very valuable.
In terms of the exhibition of your work, how do the drawings and the paintings relate to the works of sculpture we'll see?
There are not many drawings. I mean, it is a sculpture exhibition, and there are some accompanying drawings. I'd have to draw. I mean, that was my initial interest, drawing. But I have to draw anyway to explain things to myself and my assistants. I mean, there's lots of things you can't actually verbally describe. So I do a lot of drawings which are just about how to make the work, you know, what that should look like. So that's one kind of work. But then over the last 15, 20 years, I've got more and more involved in just like, it's a beautiful activity drawing. I love, you sit down with a pencil and a piece of paper, and as soon as the pencil touches the paper, this is a voyage. And this is, and it may not go very far, but I mean, the possibility is to go somewhere absolutely fantastic and new for oneself. And so there are then a second category of drawings which show a little bit sort of the things that I've thought up for myself. And the paintings are only watercolors. Yeah, but they're just, they have their own meaning and their own position in the work.
You make drawing sound like almost like a meditation.
It's a little bit more, it could be meditative, but it's a little bit more exciting than that because I had drawing quite a rhythmic way. So I'm very awake. I'm not at all, I don't really meditate. So I always think of something quite sleepy with meditation, but I'm more active, sort of generating.
Do you ever, you said you don't particularly care what people think of the work or what they take away. Do you have any interest in watching?
I can't afford to think about what they think about. That's all it is.
Do you have any interest in watching them undetected as they experience your work for the first time or anybody's work?
No, I can't really say that I don't really want to put it in my mind. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't want to be disingenuous and say I'm not absolutely interested. Of course, the difference for artists between it's a great privilege to, you know, that people come and see my work and even to have the opportunity to do exhibitions. I know a lot of great friends of mine, good artists, don't have that opportunity. But as soon as you start thinking about the recipient, you turn into a designer. You know, it's the difference between designers and artists.
Tony, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for being
pleasure.
Here.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilufer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.